You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Manifestations of Karma. This is Lecture 9, entitled Karmic Effects of Our Experiences, Karma in Relation to Death and Birth, given in Hamburg on the 26th of May, 1910. As I have already pointed out on previous occasions, I will only be able to give you an outline of the great laws of karma, which might awaken your interest in this almost immeasurable field. If you consider everything we have discussed in the last few days, it will not surprise you greatly to hear that the human being is virtually driven from out of certain layers of his consciousness to seek, also in the outside world, for the compensating effects of karmic causes acquired earlier. Thus, people may virtually be driven to places where it is possible to get an infection in order to find in this the compensating effects for certain karmic causes within them. People are even driven to what one might call fatal life events to find such compensation. How does it affect the course of karma if measures are taken which result in people being prevented from seeking this kind of compensation? Let us assume that certain causes, certain circumstances toward which someone might incline as a result of his karma, simply do not exist anymore as a result of measures of hygiene having been introduced. Imagine that particular germs had been combated successfully by a program of hygiene. We have already acquainted ourselves with the idea that it is not at all through human agency that such things come about. We have seen how the tendency to regulate matters of hygiene and sanitation reappears by its reversed repetition in evolution in a certain period, having disappeared in the interim. We learn that it is the great laws of humanity's karma as a whole which determine that such measures are adopted by man at a particular point in time. At the same time, we can easily grasp that human beings were not led to adopt such measures at an earlier time because the epidemics, which are now to be banished by means of hygienic measures, were needed by humanity in an earlier epoch. With regard to major developments in life, human evolution really is subject to definite laws, and we are not in a position to adopt such measures until they will be of significance and value for the whole of human evolution. For these measures do not spring from the fully conscious life, from the rational life between birth and death, but they spring rather from the general mind of humanity. Just call to mind how one invention or discovery or another, too, only occurs when humanity is really ready for it. A brief survey of the history of human evolution upon earth may prove useful. Let us not forget that our ancestors, that is to say our own souls, dwelt upon the old Atlantean continent in bodies quite different from the present human body. That continent was then submerged, and it was only after a definite period that the inhabitants upon the one half of the earth which had emerged were brought into contact with those of the other half. It is only recently that the peoples of Europe have been able again to reach those territories that had emerged on the other side of the submerged Atlantean continent. Indeed, such matters are ordered by great laws. The discovery of one thing or another, the adoption of measures which make it possible to intervene in the realm of karma, these things are not dependent on human beings' opinions or arbitrary decisions, but they arrive when they are due to arrive. Nevertheless, we can influence a person's karma by removing certain causes which would otherwise have existed and which would have come to him as a karmic fulfillment. This influencing does not mean that we have removed it, but merely that we have changed its direction. Let us suppose that a certain number of people are impelled by karma to seek for certain conditions, which would represent to them a karmic compensation. Through hygienic measures, these conditions have been removed for the time being and can no longer be met. These people, however, will not be liberated from the karmic effect evoked by their inner being, but will instead be urged to seek other effects. Man cannot escape his karma. Through such measures he is not freed from that which he would otherwise have sought. From this we may conclude that if the karmic reparation is escaped in one direction, it will have to be sought in another. When we abolish certain influences, we merely create the necessity of seeking other opportunities and influences. Let us assume that many epidemics, communal causes of illness, can be traced to the fact that victims are seeking to remove what they have karmically fostered within themselves. This is the case, for instance, with smallpox, which is the organ of unlovingness. Although we may be in a position to remove the possibility of this disease, the cause of unlovingness would still remain, and the souls in question would then be forced to seek another way for karmic compensation, either in this or in another incarnation. To help you understand this, I will say a few words about something which is very significant in this context. It is a fact that at the present time a whole lot of influences and causes are removed which would otherwise have been sought for as adjustment for certain karmic matters with which mankind had burdened itself in earlier periods. But in removing these influences, we only remove the possibility of man's succumbing to their external effects. In this way, human life is rendered more comfortable and also healthier outwardly. However, all that is achieved is that human beings now have to seek elsewhere for the karmic compensation associated with particular forms of illness. People whose health is spared in this way today are at the same time condemned to seek a karmic adjustment in another way. And they really do have to search for it in numerous cases similar to the one described. When life becomes physically more comfortable due to improved health conditions, the soul is affected in the opposite way. In the course of time, the soul experiences a certain emptiness, a sense of dissatisfaction, a lack of fulfillment. If the trend toward ever greater physical comfort and health continued along the lines envisaged in the context of a purely materialistic outlook on life, such souls would feel less and less incentive to progress inwardly. The whole thing would be accompanied by a stultification of the soul. If you take a closer look at life, you will see signs of this already. There has hardly been an age before ours in which so many people live in such pleasant outer conditions and yet go about with their souls barren and unoccupied. That is why such people rush from sensation to sensation. If they have enough money, they travel from town to town in order to see something. If not, they rush from pleasure to pleasure every night. Yet for all this, the soul remains empty and ends up at a complete loss about what to look for in the world to fill the void. Especially when life is exclusively geared to outer physical comfort, the inclination to think solely in terms of the physical will be strong. And if this inclination, to deal only with the physical world, had not already been prevalent for a long time, the inclination toward theoretical materialism would not have arisen to the extent we have it today. In this way, human souls are becoming more sick as physical life is rendered more healthy. Anthroposophists have least call to complain about this, since anthroposophy offers us the possibility to understand these matters and arrive at certain insights as to where compensation may be sought. Souls can only remain empty to a certain degree Then, as if through an inherent elasticity, they are bounced to the opposite. They then seek a content related to their own souls, and will then often find how badly they need to attain to a spiritual scientific view of the world. This shows us how a materialistic approach to life may well ease things on the physical side, but will at the same time create inner difficulties, which may then lead the individual concerned to seek for the content of a spiritual view of life out of his soul's suffering. The spiritual view of life, encompassed today in anthroposophy, meets those souls who find no satisfaction in the bleakness of impressions offered them by a purely external life, however comfortable it may be. Souls will continue in their search and seek ever again for new impressions until their elasticity will act so strongly in the other direction that they will feel themselves again drawn to a spiritual life. Thus there exists a relationship between hygiene and the aspirations for a future spiritual scientific view of the world. The beginnings of this are already noticeable today. There are people who add to other superficialities a new superficiality, namely an interest in the anthroposophical world conception. Such people will take up the anthroposophical world conception for the sheer sensation. It is inevitable that what is of profound inner significance also appears as fashion, as sensation, and this tendency can be traced in every current of human evolution. But those souls who are truly ripe for anthroposophy are those who fail to find satisfaction from external sensations, and who realize that natural science, in spite of all its explanations, cannot explain certain facts. These are the souls who, through their general karma, are so prepared that they become united to anthroposophy with the innermost members of their soul life. Spiritual science forms part of mankind's general karma, and as such will take its place there. Thus the karma of human beings can be redirected to a certain extent, but its effects on human beings cannot be prevented. What we have prepared for ourselves in earlier lives is bound to be fulfilled in one way or another. We can show how logical is the working out of karma in the world by considering karma where its activity is still independent of morality, where we see it manifest in the universe without concerning itself with the moral impulses emanating from the soul of man and leading him to moral or immoral deeds. We shall set before ourselves an aspect of karma in which morality plays no part, but in which something neutral appears as a karmic link. Let us suppose that a woman lives in a certain incarnation. It cannot be denied that this woman, by reason of her sex, will undergo experiences which differ from those of a man, and that these are not merely dependent on her inner soul life, but are connected predominantly with external happenings, with circumstances in which she will find herself simply because she is a woman, and which will in turn react upon the whole of the state and disposition of her soul. It is reasonable to say that women are led to act in ways which are intimately connected with the fact of being a woman. After all, it is only in the realm of spiritual companionship that the male and the female are balanced. The further we penetrate into the pure soul nature and the outer aspect of the human being, the more accentuated we find the differences between men and women in relation to their lives. We can say that women differ from men also in certain soul qualities, that they have a greater inclination to those qualities of soul which lead to impulses that can only be termed emotional. Women are more disposed to soul experience than men. Intellectuality and materialism, in other words, that which has come about through men, are more natural to men's lives, and this deeply affects their soul life. a closer connection with the soul and the feelings in the case of the woman, and with the intellectual and materialistic in the case of the man. This is how it is actually determined by their respective natures. This is why women display certain nuances in their soul life by virtue of being female. I have already described to you how that which we experience as qualities in the soul between death and a new birth forces its way into our next bodily organization. That which is related more strongly to the psyche, to the emotions, and tends more toward the inner soul between birth and death, will have a greater tendency to enter more profoundly into the organism and to impregnate it far more intensely. And women, through their aptitude to absorb impressions related to the psyche, to the emotions, will take the experiences of life, too, into greater depths of soul. Men may have richer and also more scientific experiences, but these do not penetrate the man's soul life as deeply as they do in the case of a woman. The whole of the world of her experiences is deeply graven into a woman's soul. Therefore, those experiences will have a stronger tendency to work into the organism, to embrace the organism more closely in the future. In this way, a woman will, through her experiences in one incarnation, develop a tendency toward deeper intervention in the organism, and thereby toward the formation of the organism itself in the next incarnation. A deep working into and working through the organism will bring forth a male organism. A male organism appears when the forces of the soul desire to be more deeply graven into matter. You can see from this that the woman's experiences in one incarnation result in a male organism in the next incarnation. Occult teaching here shows that there is a connection which lies outside the bounds of morality. For this reason, occultism states man is woman's karma. The male organism of a later incarnation is the result of the experiences and events of a preceding female incarnation. Even at the risk of giving discomfort to some of those present here, after all, many men today are horrified at the thought of incarnating as women, I must state these facts entirely objectively. Now, how about the experiences specific to men? We shall best understand them if we base them on what has been said before. In the male organism, the inner man has penetrated more thoroughly into matter and has embraced it more closely than in the female. Women retain more of the spiritual in the non-physical sphere. They do not penetrate so deeply into matter and keep what is physical more flexible. The separation from the spiritual is not as complete. It is characteristic of the female nature that a greater degree of free spirituality is retained, and for that reason women do not penetrate as profoundly into matter and keep their brains more flexible. Therefore, it is not surprising that women have a special inclination for what is new, especially in the spiritual realm, because the spiritual has been retained more freely and because there is less resistance. And it is not by accident, but in accordance with a profound law, that in a movement which in its very nature deals with spirituality, there should be a greater number of women than men. Every man knows that the male brain is frequently an intractable instrument. On account of its rigidity, it offers terrible resistance when one wants to use it for more flexible lines of thought. It refuses to follow, and it must first be educated by all sorts of means before it can lose its rigidity. Every man will have experienced this. The nature of the male is more condensed, more concentrated. It has been compressed more, rendered more rigid and hard by his inner being. It has been made more material. Now, a more rigid brain is first and foremost an instrument for the intellectual, rather than for the soul. for intellectuality deals mainly with the physical plane. What might be called the intellectualism of the male is a consequence of a more rigid, more solidified brain. In this respect, we might speak of the brain as being frozen to a certain degree. If it is to find its way into subtler trains of thought, it must first be thawed. Therefore, a man will be inclined to grasp the external and to absorb less of those experiences that are connected with the depths of his soul life. What he does absorb does not penetrate deeply. We have an external proof of this in the shallowness of external science and its comparative failure to comprehend the inner being. Although much thought is expended in a wide circumference, facts are concentrated with little thoroughness. Anyone who is compelled by their own discipline of thinking to put the facts together might experience occasional nausea at what is so bluntly presented as objective fact in the field of ordinary science. It becomes quite clear, then, how little depth there is. Let me quote an example of the superficiality of modern science. Let us suppose a young man is in a college where a rabid Darwinian is lecturing. This is how the advocate of the theory of selection will characterize certain facts. Quote, "Whence does a cock derive his beautiful iridescent feathers of bluish tints?" Close quote. This is to be traced back to sexual natural selection, for the cock attracts the hens by his colors, and the hens will choose those from among the cocks who possess these bluish iridescent feathers. In this way, the other cocks are ignored, and the consequence is that one particular species is developed. This is progress. This is, quote, natural selection, close quote, and the student is glad to know how progressive development is brought about. Then he goes to the next hall, where physiology of the senses is dealt with. It may well happen that the same student in this second hall will hear the following, quote, "Experiments have been made which show how the various colors of the spectrum affect various beings," close quote. It can be proved that of the whole color spectrum, hens, for instance, can only see the colors ranging from green to orange and red to ultra-red, but not those ranging from blue to violet. Now, a student, if he wants to combine these two facts, which really are taught today, is forced to take things superficially. The whole of the theory of natural selection is based on the hens perceiving the cock's variegated colors, which is supposed to give them special pleasure, but which they don't see in reality, for the colors appear raven black to them. This is merely an example, but anyone willing to investigate really scientifically will encounter instances of this kind wherever he goes. This will demonstrate that intellectuality does not penetrate very deeply into life, but remains on the surface. I deliberately chose crass examples. You might find it hard to believe that intellectuality is something that tends to take place on the surface and does not work deeply into the life of the soul, hardly takes hold of man's inner being. And the materialistic frame of mind takes even less hold of the soul. The consequence of this is that an incarnation in which little has penetrated into the soul will bring forth a tendency between birth and death to penetrate less deeply into the organism in the next incarnation. After all, the individuality would have taken up less strength to do this. That is why it now results in the human being penetrating less deeply into his body. So comes the inclination to build up a female body in the next incarnation, and it is therefore correct when occultism says, "Woman is man's karma." We can see in this morally neutral sphere that what we prepare in one incarnation will organize our corporeality in the next. And as these things not only affect our inner life profoundly, but also affect how we experience things and what we do, the following is true. A human being's experience as a man or a woman in one incarnation will determine what this person will do outwardly in the next. The female experience will produce an inclination to build a male organism, and the male experience will produce an inclination to build a female organism. Incarnations in the same sex rarely succeed one another. At the most, it can happen 7 times. However, as a rule, the male organism will strive to become female in the next incarnation, and vice versa. No amount of personal dislike will change these matters, as it is not a question of what we want in the physical world, but solely a matter of the tendencies developed between death and a new birth. And these are determined on more sensible grounds than the fact that someone incarnated as a man might experience horror at the thought of incarnating as a woman next time around. You can see how one life is karmically determined by the preceding one, and how this equally affects what we do in life. Now, we need to look into yet another karmic connection in order to gain a clearer idea of the fundamental questions we will consider in the next few days. Let us look back once more to a rather distant time in human evolution, the time when human beings began to incarnate on Earth. This happened in the ancient Lemurian epoch. I would ask you to recall that at first the Luciferic influence worked deeply into man, and then called forth the Ahrimanic influence. Try and present before your souls how the Luciferic influence affected human life externally. The very fact that man attained the capacity to absorb the Luciferic influence in those ancient times, in other words, to permeate his astral body with the Luciferic influence, had the effect that his astral body was inclined to penetrate far more deeply into the organism, into the material part of the physical body, and to do so in quite a different way. Through the Luciferic influence, the human being became more material. Without this influence, the human tendency to descend into the material world would have been far weaker, and man would have remained in higher spheres of existence. In other words, his outer and his inner aspects became more strongly united than they would have been without the Luciferic influence. The first effect of this more intimate connection with the material physical body was that we lost the ability to remember what happened before we took up our physical body. We entered existence by way of birth, which strongly tied us to matter. This effaced all memory of earlier experiences. The Luciferic influence made birth into an act through which our physical aspect becomes so intimately connected with the spiritual aspect that everything experienced in the spiritual world before birth is effaced. The Luciferic influence robbed us of our memory of earlier spiritual experiences. It is due to this connection with the outer physical body that we cannot look back on what happened before. That is why we depend in our life on gaining knowledge and experience from the outer world. However, it would be totally wrong to believe that we are only affected by the coarse outer substances we absorb. Besides the food we eat and the forces connected with such nutrition, all our experiences, too, affect us, even the things that flow into us through our senses. But through this coarser connection with matter, the foods, too, work differently. Imagine that the Luciferic influence had not occurred. Then everything, from the food we eat to the impressions of our senses, would work into us in a far more subtle way. We would be able to imbue everything we experience by interacting with the outside world with our experiences between death and birth. Because of the greater condensation of the physical, we also tend to absorb what is denser. This is the work of the Luciferic influence. Through the condensation of matter, the human being draws much denser matter from the world outside. This denser matter, which he draws in from outside, is of a very different quality than the otherwise less dense substance. the lower degree of density would have enabled us to retain our memories of our earlier existence. A further effect would be a sense of certainty that everything we experience between birth and death has repercussions into infinity. We would know for certain, quote, it's true that outwardly death takes place, but everything that happens carries on working, close quote. Because we had to absorb denser matter, we brought about an intense interaction between our bodily nature and the world around us from the time of our birth onward. What is the effect of this state of interaction? All memory of the spiritual world is eclipsed from the time of our birth. And to enable us to live in the spiritual, to wake up in the spiritual world, that state has to be restored, where all that has entered into us as denser matter from outside must be taken from us again. To re-enter the spiritual world, we must wait for the time when the outer material body is taken from us. That which enters us as denser matter from the time we are born destroys our human corporeality step by step. Our bodily matter is gradually destroyed by all that enters us in this way until the destruction is so complete that the body can exist no longer. From the time we are born, we take up matter which is of greater density than we would have done without the luciferic influence. We slowly destroy our body until it is totally unusable. This is when death occurs. This shows us that the luciferic influence is the karmic cause of human death. If human beings were not born in this way, they could not die in this way. Or else we would face death with a certain prospect of what is to come. Death is the karmic consequence of birth. Birth and death are linked by karma. Without the kind of birth we experience today, there would not be death as we experience it today. As I have said already, we cannot refer to karma in relation to the animal as we do in relation to man. If someone stated that even for the animal, birth and death are karmically linked, he would only show that he is not aware of the very different quality of human death and animal death. What might look similar from the outside is not the same within. It is the inner experience and not the outer event which is significant in birth and death. In the case of an animal, only the generic soul or group soul experiences what takes place. For the group soul, the death of an animal is approximately the same as what you experience when you have your hair cut at the beginning of summer. Your hair will then slowly grow back. The group soul of an animal species experiences an animal's dying like the dying off of a limb, which will gradually be replaced again. We can compare the group soul to the human eye. It doesn't know birth or death and has an uninterrupted awareness of what precedes birth and of what follows death. To speak of an animal's birth and death in the same way as we speak of man's would be absurd, as they are preceded by quite different causes. We would deny the inner activity of the spirit if we were to assume that what appears identical on the outside must be brought about by identical inner causes. Identity of outer processes doesn't necessarily point to identical inner causes. The birth of a human being rests on very different causes than that of an animal. And likewise, human beings die for very different reasons from animals. That this is so can be ascertained methodologically by just mulling over for a bit how things can be identical outside and not be remotely the same inside. It is extremely simple to find out that what you perceive with your senses is no proof of what goes on inside. Think of two people. You arrive at a particular place at 9 o'clock and see these two people standing next to each other. At 3 o'clock you return to that place, having not been there in the meantime. You see the two people standing at the identical spot again. Now, you might conclude A is still at the same spot, B is still at the same spot, exactly where they were at 9 o'clock. However, if you were to examine what these people have done in the meantime, you might find that one stayed at the spot while the other had taken a long walk in the meantime and got tired. What you see has been caused by totally different processes. It would be nonsense to say that the two people must have had identical inner experiences because they are standing at the same spot again at 3 o'clock. And it is equally nonsense to conclude from the identical structure of two cells of the same shape that their inner meaning is one and the same. What is important is to know the overall context of facts which have resulted in a particular cell arriving at a particular place. That is why modern cell physiology, which is based on analyzing the inner cell structure, is utterly misguided. What we are able to perceive with our physical senses can never ever be proof of the inner nature of the phenomenon concerned. Anyone who wishes to grasp what may be derived from occult observation, such as the fact that being born or dying is fundamentally different in the human being from what it is in the mammal or even in birds, will have to think these things through properly. It will only be possible to study these things properly when a little more attention is paid again to what spiritual research yields in these matters. As long as this is not the case, natural science, which stops at the sense perceptible and the external, will certainly bring to light all sorts of wonderful facts. Yet, whatever human beings may bring forth about such facts, under these circumstances, will never relate to reality. This is why all that constitutes today's theoretical science is a figment of imagination, utterly fantasy. Brought about through correlating outer facts on the basis of their outer appearance. In many areas, it is the outer facts and circumstances themselves that urge us to interpret them correctly. Yet the general approach adopted today will not make it happen. Now, we have considered two neutral issues that relate to the laws of karma, and you will find this a useful background to our further studies. We have learned that the female organism is the karmic consequence of experiencing life as a man, and that the male organism is the karmic consequence of experiencing life as a woman. And finally, we grasp that death is the karmic effect of birth in human life. If you endeavor gradually to deepen your understanding of these things, you may attain deep insights into the karmic connections of human life. The end of Lecture 9.